This week's episodes of Hodinkee Radio are proudly sponsored by our partners at UBS. Stay tuned later in the episode for what we're planning this year in celebration of all things horology. And keep an eye out for the return of UBS House of Craft. Hello and welcome to Day 3 at Watches and Wonders. We are, of course, here for another episode of Hodinkee Radio, recapping some of the great watches we saw today, yesterday, maybe even the day before. It's been a hectic, pretty fun day. Today, lots going on, lots of running around. I'm joined by Rich, Malaika, and Tim. And we've got lots of stuff to talk about. I know. Especially, I've got a chance. Malaika and Rich on the same show. We got to do some Cartier, I guess, right?
Okay.
Because we got a little bit of Augustin in yesterday, but there was 60 new watches. Some of them stuff I've never seen before or didn't know could be a watch.
Oh, really?
Just more and more Panthers.
Okay. Yeah, Panther. It's a big motif.
Yeah.
But I feel like we should start with high level, sort of, you know, important.
High level and
yeah, what got you excited?
Yeah.
Guichet is amazing. I love it. It's like a stripped down, super industrial tank. The all brush look, I mean, it's for me, when I pick it up, like I said, I get the feelings of a vintage watch, and that rarely happens with stuff that is thoroughly modern. I don't mean that it's light. I don't mean that it's not well made.
It's very convincing.
It's very convincing as a re-edition, and that's actually really hard to do. Many brands just don't get it right. But in terms of commercial product, I thought the Tank Louis automatics were great. The new gray dial in the Tank Louis is amazing. Really a lot of stuff from Cartier that is, like Ben was saying days ago, super sellable. The new small Santos, both in all steel and two-tone, there's a watch that references the Galbi from the 90s and the 80s.
The Galbi.
Sure. I thought it was really good.
Can I ask you a question about the Guichet?
Mm-hmm.
I really like it, but I'm struggling with the fact that there's so much level surface area. Obviously, there are no more like pronounced poincare on the side.
Yeah.
Like, does it make it look kind of odd proportionally? Like, that's a lot of surface area, and obviously the apertures are quite small.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I think if there's one criticism of the watch, it's the size of the apertures. It's hard, given the way that jump hours work, to make apertures larger. The discs would have to be larger, therefore the movement, and to keep the case the size that they did, to make it something I would even call a re-edition, it has to be that size. So then therefore the movement can't size up any further and the discs have to be that size. I will say in the photos, it's worse.
Okay.
In the metal, you have all of three, maybe four numbers to look at, and it's quite easy to tell what time it is.
I found it to be perfectly glanceable. Right. It's small, but it's not an imperceptible number.
And I'm not saying that you can't tell what time it is.
I probably can't, to be honest. I am trying on Eric Koo's 96 CPCP version that night.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a different experience.
Yeah. The one difference in this watch versus the previous editions and even the original is that the minutes aperture is a bit lower.
Okay.
And I think maybe visually, because they're so far apart, it makes them look smaller. But it does, I said, even compared to the vintage ones, it more directly references the 1928 edition. So the Guichet is a hard one to do a re-edition of, because every one from the 20s and 30s is slightly different. Mm. Some, like you were saying, have Brancards, and I'm going to use my American pronunciation
Yeah.
Some have, some don't. The first one that they made does not. Mm. And it has that lower minutes register, and they're wanting to be original to the original design. But yeah, I do think it does make the apertures look a little bit smaller.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was a bunch of other stuff at Cartier, including a lot of gem setting, which obviously, you know, speaks to me. I'm trying to remember. Those two bangles were pretty cool. But that sort of high jewelry watch hybrid. That's like, you know, that's your bowling out.
Can we talk Tressage?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I love the Tressage, but people are either really into it or really freaked out by it.
Yeah.
But I figured it out. It's challah bread.
Ah, okay.
I was talking to the Davidoff brothers, and they were like, come on, Malaika, fellow Jew, challah. And I was like, oh, right, yeah, that's what it looks like. the kind of, or a unicorn horn. I'm going unicorn horn. Yeah, yeah. Unicorn. I think it's really beautiful, especially in the plain yellow gold with the black strap.
Yeah.
It's.
Do you remember the weirdest thing it reminded me of?
What?
Like I held it and looked at it, and what popped up in my mind were the candy Richard Merles.
Oh my God, the bonbon collection because of the like marshmallow.
Yeah, it's the puffiness.
Oh my God,
and there's like,
exactly
it feels like, it feels like they made a shape out of gold and then pushed air into it. And it kind of like, because there's like a surface tension to the way all the little nodules kind of load up.
I called it, we have this candy in the UK that's like twisted marshmallows that are like really puffy and twisted.
Does that have a hilarious name?
It's
Twirly Puff.
They're
cool. It's funnier than Twirly Puff, isn't it?
They're called Plumps.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, and it was.
It was. I wasn't even, I shouldn't even have bothered trying. You can't, yeah.
Clearly you didn't read my story in the CMS, did you?
No. Flumps and Jammy Dodgers.
Flumps and Jammy Dodgers. Yeah, we love the Tressage. I think it's
interesting
really cool
that they would have gone with the name Tressage instead of Flump, but, you know, I'm not.
Well, it means braided in French.
Okay.
And I don't know, in case you didn't know, I speak French. I don't think it's like a commercial product. I think it's just Cartier flexing on their jewelry.
No, I've never seen anything quite like it.
It's definitely not. When I saw the photos in the press release, the first thing I thought of was, God, I hope that arches to my wrist and doesn't fit weird because I want to love it.
Yeah.
And it actually fit really, really well on my wrist. I think I was maybe at the top end of the spectrum where that arch starts to be a problem. Mm-hmm. Like if you're above 7.25, not that anyone like needs help buying this watch. I'm sure they would go and see it in person if they really wanted it, but it's just a cool thing, especially with the trend for weird shapes. And like, you know, tonight there's an auction at Sotheby's with all these strange things and it's themed UFOs. And that's really coming back. And Cartier knows what they're doing.
It's very 80s.
Yeah.
It looks, you know, it references like some classic styles of Cartier jewelry in the 80s. I think they're kind of just having fun, which is cool. But Cartier is always a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I want to bring in our good buddy Tim here. You know, you saw Panerai today. I didn't get a chance to see them. What kind of struck you from them?
Well, first of all, walking into the
A booth.
The underwater booth was a nice juxtaposition between the beige around all around. but a few things caught my eye. First, two updates to the Luminor Mariner collection. And as they told me, they're not super sexy updates, but they're updates that people wanted and people have demanded from previous collections. 12% decrease in case sizing while increasing in movement size and certain capabilities there. Also, what really was my personal favorite was the perpetual calendar, 45 millimeter, the Platinum Tech. It's really nice. Obviously comes with the crown guards that Panerai is known for. And it also comes in an alligator strap, rubber strap. And what I really liked was the fact that not all the complications were on the front. They had a couple on the back. You had the power reserve on the back. You got the leap year indicator on the back. You got the month on the back. And as they told me, it was, that's for you. Those complications are for you. They're not outwardly facing. And obviously, you know, you have to take the watch off to see those. So it was a really, really nice. I had a really nice time underwater with Panerai and got a really, really nice booth. And there's some really classic updates there.
Where are you at with the Panerai look? And I'm not setting you up for criticism, but I just want to give you some context. Walking around the streets of New York, whenever I see a Panerai, the guy is wearing tailoring like 80% of the time.
Oh yeah, totally.
So as someone who wears a suit every day and a tie, which you're known for at this point.
Tim wears a suit and tie every day. Which, by the way, is iconic.
Why would I not?
I was like, do we think Tim wears a tie on the plane? Confirmed?
I used to.
Okay.
I used to wear a full Tom Brown suit on the plane for many years. Now I go no tie.
Okay.
But I think about it. I'm obviously wearing a blazer, though. I mean, come on.
Okay, gotta wear a blazer. Yeah. So as a man of, you know, good taste and suiting, are you, that's a good question.
Yeah, where are you at with Panerai as a brand and sort of the look? Because I think it does translate at some level, but I've never been able to understand how it does.
First of all, I don't own a Panerai. However, like, I do think, and I come from the world of sport. I'm a big runner. I'm a big athlete. So I like the heritage with diving that comes along with Panerai. You know, the coloring of the dial in the Luminor Mariner collection, I think I actually really like. And I think it really pairs well with tailoring. I don't, for me, I'm maybe not the first watch I would buy, maybe reach to in my collection. However, I could see it working its way in there at some point. And I do think it pairs well with, it's interesting. I've not seen that, but now I'll keep my eye out. It's like,
you'll see it everywhere.
When you drive a car for the first time, like, oh, I've never seen those anywhere. And they just pop up everywhere now that you're noticing it. So right. I'll report back in a few months' time and we'll see how many Panerais I've seen on the streets. But I think it actually could work well.
I want to see it someday. I want to see you in a Panerai around the city.
I like it. I tried them on today. I think they look really nice. And I think that, I am wearing the Navy suit today, really proud to wear out the Navy dial. So I think it works well.
As we know, I'm gunning for a Panerai return just because, why not?
Everything comes back around. And not to say that Panerai is not doing well, but the sizing with trends is currently a headwind. Yep, can't get around that. But like I said, when you see everyday guys around New York City, it's a lot of Panerai.
There's a lot of men who never took off the Panerai.
Right.
They put the Panerai on in the 2010s, and it's still.
Yeah. It is hard to remember how big a deal they were in 2008.
Huge.
First story I ever wrote about a watch was a Panerai. Yeah. I was obsessed with Radomir. Really love them. My tastes have shifted towards smaller watches, only because my wrists haven't gotten any bigger since 2008. I just thought I'd keep growing. It's a moment. But I love the look. I really do. I don't have a huge love of big watches. But then summer comes along, and I've got a couple big watches. You put them on, and they're just fun. Yeah. I don't know how. I think if I wore it with a suit, I would feel self conscious about it.
Yeah.
If it didn't kind of slide under. But then some of the Radomirs are pretty slim.
Right.
Well, the best reference for me was that picture I sent you the other day when you were like, "Who's?" I've never seen a picture of Marc Jacobs before, and I burned James, but he's just wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt, smoking a cigarette, and the Panerai is hanging off his wrist, and I'm like, that is perfect.
Incredible.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, one of the biggest fans in my life of Panerai is my wife, who has a very tiny wrist.
Oh my God, I forget
about
this.
But she adores 44 millimeter Luminors on loose bracelets on cheap women.
Darren is what's up.
Yeah, it's a good look for sure.
And I will say the 44, I drowned on the 44. I've got a tiny wrist, and it wore small. It was big on my wrist, but it wasn't hanging off my wrist, basically.
It's not the same 44 as a big Rolex Diver or a giant Breitling or a big IWC. Yeah. They wear it a little bit differently because of the lug shape and that kind of thing. Well, look, we're making some right turns, some zigs and zags here, so let's find another one. You want to do a little bit of Chanel? Because you saw some stuff you were excited about, right?
Obviously, I am a big fan of Chanel watchmaking. They have brilliant minds at the helm of the brand currently, including their CEO of watchmaking, Frederic Rangier, I think his name is. He's an icon. He also used to work with Marc Jacobs back in the early 2000s.
There you go.
So he's like a man after my own heart. They are obviously kind of interesting in the watch space, given their recent acquisition of a minority stake in MB&F. They also own a minority stake in F.P. Jean, Raymond Gauthier. They're kind of out here doing a lot in watchmaking.
The Canisi connection.
The Canisi, Canisi connection. Also, they make...
The business is fascinating.
It's huge. It's varied. They make a lot of the ceramic for a lot of the big brands. So it's kind of interesting to see how much kind of influence they have and how much they take back from these smaller independent brands. So we had a good conversation about that. They've got this newly designed, updated J12 in this navy blue ceramic, which is, to be honest with you, when I look at kind of all the blue ceramic, it's a trend, obviously AP, now Zenith, multiple brands. This ceramic blue is elite compared to these other colors of blue. It's a midnight blue, black. It's just a little bit more sophisticated, I would say.
Finishing is a different level as well, because it's matte.
It's so stunning. And it's 25th anniversary of J12. They have this crazy flying tourbillon with a diamond on the cage that's insane. And it's legit watchmaking. They're kind of killing it. And they're kind of doing it quietly. And I think they are going for this sort of long-term approach in the way that Frederick explained to me. Just like they did with perfume 100 years ago, they bought from the Grasse family, you know, the birthplace of perfume, basically. It's still the same family who produces Chanel No. 5. And, like, they hope to do the same with watchmaking. So I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah. The blue ceramic looks great. I feel like I really like the idea of a ceramic watch, and then they are mirror shiny almost all the time.
All shiny and flashy and weird.
The funny thing is I feel like that was a bit of a calling card for previous J12s, that almost liquid-like smoothness, that pebble shape, the roundness, and the rest of it. And then you see these in the matte, and you just go like, that is so sick.
It's so really thick. Good. It's subtle as well. And I think, you know,
Such an interesting choice.
It's an interesting choice
to go with something.
And
like
I try not to lean too much into the gender neutrality conversation, but obviously that's, you know, they're playing on that because that could work for men, that could work for women. I also think Chanel is not afraid to kind of own the fact that they are a brand for women.
Yeah.
And they're sort of proud of that. But I think they're going to welcome more men into the fold probably quite soon.
And I will say, as a side note, around town, you know, they have Watches and Wonders ads, some of the releases. And I feel like Chanel has my favorite one of those. It's not even a picture of the watch. It's not white. It's not black. It's blue.
Yeah.
And I think I noticed that when I came into town. I really like that. You know, it speaks to the power of the brand where they don't even need to put the watch on the ad. People know what it is.
Yeah. I just think it's Chanel, you know, like they don't really need help.
It's Chanel, and like you look at the business elements that you talked about at the top. They have refused to approach watches like every other fashion brand. They went, no, we can do this our way. In 25 years, 20 years,
you know, Jason. So they start. They bought a manufacturer. The name I can't remember. It escapes me. In 1993. And then they developed the J12. It came out in 1999, 2000. And they've been doing like kind of crazy things ever since. We were talking about this dial on this watch they have that's like shaped like a seamstress pincushion. The dial was developed by Jean. So like kind of doing crazy cool stuff and in a legitimate way.
Yeah, that's the level they're playing in for sure. That's very cool.
It's cool.
Yeah. Special thanks again to our partners at UBS for their support of Hodinkee Radio. Last October, Hodinkee and UBS brought together some of the most influential personalities and brands in the industry to celebrate all things watches. This year, we're partnering again with expanded events across the U.S. in addition to our fall House of Craft in New York. Stay tuned to Hodinkee for updates on these events and other projects with our friends at UBS. Now, back to the show. All right. Speaking of great watchmaking, you're just fresh back from Chopard, correct?
Yeah, just walked in the door from it.
What'd you think? Because you're a fan to begin with. And they had some real variety this year.
Yeah, I'm a big fan to begin with. And maybe I talk in praise about the things that I do talk about, but I'm extremely picky about modern watches.
no shit.
And I mentioned to people at Chopard who I've never met before when I was leaving, and I just said, you know, just that. I am extremely picky, and I just want to tell you, when I tell you that I like stuff from the LUC collection, it's because I actually do like it, and I think that they're doing great things. I think the new Quattro is like, it's in precious metal. I know it's expensive, but it is what they're trying to do is similar to a Patek discontinuing the 5711, their most like wanted for product, and they're making something very, very similar to the 1860 in salmon, in different colors, yes, but that watch wears so well, and it's either 38 or 39. I didn't check my notes before getting on the podcast, but it was just on my wrist as someone who's wearing a 33 millimeter watch. It wore so well. The tweaks that they've made to the case and of that watch and other LUCs, and will continue to carry out through the other models in the collection. They're not in a hurry to make those design tweaks, but when they come out with a new model, whether it's more about the movement. If they make a tweak to the overall aesthetic or the movement, they will put that new case design in, but they're not in a rush. And they, I don't know if they're going to change the case to the 1860, which is what I asked them specifically about, because everyone loves that watch so much. But yeah, I walked back in the door, had that Quattro on my wrist for like most of the meeting.
Everything was okay.
They showed that watch second. I put it on my wrist and continued to look at other watches, but just kept that watch.
Just enjoy.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, so I like a watch. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
You
did it already.
Yeah. We're proud of you.
Yeah.
We're
I can go home now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Watches and Wonders 2025. Rich Forden likes modern watches.
That's great. Well, let's jump to one that I really liked. And it was a meeting you guys didn't come with. I was with Tantan. I haven't been to a Nomos meeting in a few years. They're just the schedules didn't line up. And this year, they, you know, I have a well-documented nerd level taste for multiple time zone watches, travel watches. And, you know, Nomos has had had their, you know, world timer, the Zurich and such, for some time. And now they have a new version, which in my opinion is in like a more everyday kind of friendly, cheerful kind of outlay, which is this Sport Club world timer. It's in 8 versions. There's 2 standards and there's 6 LEs. They all have their own name, but each color has their own name. If you're wondering, I like Volcano and Glacier. Neither of those really seem to link up with the colors, but they look amazing.
Two opposite ends of the polar.
Yeah, exactly. One's like a dark steely gray with some reddish accents, and one's like a light blue, the Glacier, with like a tan accent and some light red as well. And it's a new movement. It's very thin. It largely captures the same function that you'd see in their other kind of multiple time zone watch, their GMT. Or the, you know, their world timer. So you have the push button action that allows you to basically have a little sub dial that's your home time and you sync the two. And then when you travel, you literally just update a ring for the city to put the new time zone you're in at 12. And as you do that, the ring adjusts as the hour hand jumps. It's just clever. And if you've ever played with these sorts of things, and I'm sure some of you listening will, usually you press it 3 or 4 times and the first 3 or 4 are quite crispy and then they get softer. And then they like half actuate. I just sat there just hitting it again and again, and it just spins and it just goes and goes and goes. It's nicely made. I really like the colors. I mean, Nomos is just like, it's lovable. The product they make is lovable. It's also, you know, outside of things like the Farer, which is a traditional 24-hour world timer, this is more of a GMT with a world timer aesthetic. Unlike something like the Farer, they don't really have a ton of competition. We're talking about $4,000 price point on a bracelet if you want. I prefer it on like the Ahoy style strap. I'd probably just wear it on a NATO. Yeah, I love being excited about something from Nomos, so that makes me happy.
Yeah, you came back with a giant smile.
Oh yeah, I mean, look at your GMT. This is why I do this. It's fun. And it doesn't look like my other 20 GMTs. This is great.
Another one to add to the box.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, cool.
Nomos is a cool one because it's either you start at Nomos and love the design, because they've done a great job of keeping the look of the brand the same.
Yeah.
Especially over the last 2 years, but adding in a bunch of color,
yep.
Which is cool. But to get back to my original point, you either start by loving Nomos, or maybe you eventually, after a long time, be like, oh, I have to own a Nomos now.
So my thing with Nomos was always just extreme decision fatigue. Because there's the, you know, let's say that if Nomos makes 30 different models, 28 of them are very similar. Yeah. Like they have this very specific, you know, Bauhaus derived work bun style aesthetic, and it really does flow across. So like, how do you pick between a Tetra and a Tangomatic and a this and a that? And they used to have a GMT in that model, which I really like. And I've always had kind of an appreciation for the club, especially if you remember when they first launched the club, they did like a silver with like the California dial. It was just kind of fun, and it was like, I think, just under $2,000, which is just a very reasonable for what they're offering. Take it up to something like this, you know, you're spending a bit more money, but I think you're getting something, one, that doesn't feel like it came from any other brand. And two, the use of color, to extend upon your second point there, the use of color really helps me break up the decision fatigue. Because there's a function I like, there's a bunch of colors, so they're very obviously quite honest. Also, just credit where credit's due. I usually think that red on a watch is very difficult. Red and yellow, very tough colors to do. They have a red I've never seen on a watch before. That's really nice. A bunch of people in the booth were wearing it. It suited like different skin colors. Like red looks really weird on my skin.
You think yellow is weird too? You like love yellow doxes.
Yeah, but they do great yellow.
Okay.
I don't think yellow is weird. Yellow is a very hard color to get right.
Yeah. It's
because
like
the moment you make it shiny.
Yeah.
Oh, the Rolex yellow is amazing.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's
just
great.
Just clarifying, because that's
and there's this nice Rolex's yellow leans just slightly orange, which
okay.
I really
you like.
You like
a bright.
Yeah. Well, see, if it's going to be yellow, make it yellow.
Make it sure. Yellow. Make it sunshine.
Yeah, bananas.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah,
for sure.
Just checking.
Yeah.
Speaking of color, Piaget.
Piaget. Oh, yeah, talk a little Piaget.
Piaget was so fun. Piaget was so fun. I went twice. I went yesterday for a vintage presentation, which was fun.
And then you came back and told me you need to go to Piaget.
Yeah. I literally was like, where is Rich
A box
Gordon?
Of stuff that you were excited about. Yeah.
They sat down with a really beautifully designed sort of turquoise leather briefcase.
Oh, it wasn't just like a pelican?
No. It was stunning, branded, not James Stacey style.
Stickers?
The very lovely heritage director, Emma, opens the box. Stunning array of stone dials, shaped watches. So I dragged you back today, and then we got to see the new Polo 79 in white gold. Different, super different in white gold. I said wearable, maybe more wearable than yellow. What did you think?
Definitely more wearable. Yeah. I mean, that comes with the territory of white versus yellow, especially in a watch with a full bracelet like that and such a distinct design. But funny part about the vintage appointment is it seems like word's gotten around because our appointment was quite busy.
It was massive. I was like, well, what happened to my one-on-one?
So how many people did you tell about this vintage?
I thought I was special.
Went right into the WhatsApp.
Yeah, like, guys, everybody, come to the booth. No, it's cool to see the vintage because then you sort of take away the different elements and then you can sort of match them up to the modern releases.
Right. And there's a direct reference for the new 60s. Obviously, if you can't imagine, it's from the 60s.
It's from 69.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. The new women's line, quite small, asymmetric shape. I think they're kind of cool, actually.
Yeah. It's a bit like a television shape is what we call it in vintage land.
And television. Got it. How sophisticated.
Yeah. That's cool. The 60.
Yeah.
Yeah. The story's on the site.
Yeah. Stories live now on the site. Check it out. Yep.
Bodinky.com.
Yeah. Who wrote that one?
Oh, I'm not sure. I love it. It's got a bit of a reference to the Warhol with the stepped case, too. We saw a new Warhol.
We saw an insane new Warhol.
They have a Warhol in the base?
They have two. They have an opal dial. Mesmerizing.
Opal dial with a... very, very tiny baguette sapphires on each of the steps.
Yeah.
And then a row, just in case.
Just in case.
A row of sapphires also on the case back.
Yeah.
It's just an insane thing. But I the worst part about coming to this is that you seem to leave every booth liking the most expensive watch.
I know.
At least for me, and maybe that's just my personality.
No, I think that's most people.
But when it's insane like that, on a whole nother level, then it's easier to make the case of like, yeah, well, that's fine then.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I want to run the clock just briefly because I just realized where we started this morning. I was quite excited. The IWC Ingenieur 35 absolutely rips on wrist. It's like, I guess it's about $2,000 less than a 40.
Yeah.
It's a Val Fleurier movement, so it's Richemont in-house. It's not IWC's in-house, if that matters to you by the 40, I guess. I think the sizing is more important on something that's time and date.
It does rip.
It rips.
It rips. And it rips on your wrist and my wrist and your wrist.
It's about,
and probably your wrist.
I think it's $9,950, something like that. That's a punchy price point. There's a lot of competition at $10,000.
Black dial, white dial.
And it wears like 35.
I will say the rose gold is very rose, but the dial is sick on the rose gold.
So the... all it made me think was like that new monoface with the Milanese bracelet, which is just stunningly gorgeous. Please check this out on the website. Even if you're not like, if you're in your mind, you're like, reversos. I don't
know. No.
This dial texture matched with that bracelet.
It's gorgeous.
It's like the gold created something in its own world and brought it to us.
Wow.
It feels like that came right out of the mines.
Wow. What a visual.
It's very cool. And I think I got a little bit of that from the 35.
I'm really impressed with the way that they matched the dial. It's not like an exact match, but it's like the hue corresponds really nicely to the pink of the brace. Like it's done really well. And you looked great in the rose gold.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. You know, it's one of those things where I like the 40 quite a bit. And I think that after 2 years on the market, they've kind of gotten to a point where people understand how it sits in the world of the Nautilus and now the Cubitus and the Royal Oak and the Alpine Eagle. We could do this for about 25 more minutes. But I really thought the watch was impressive. I liked much of the lineup that they had this year. But like if you're looking at the tray of it, all of us started just picking up the 335s.
Oh my God. We were neglecting the 40.
A little bit. The green one for the F1 film, I think that's quite an interesting colorway. I don't remember the last time I saw like a metallic olive green with gold accents. And, you know, Tantan, big green fan, so we should get his sort of feelings on that. Yeah. But
you wrote the story about, they're calling that, I mean, people around here are calling that the Brad Pitt. I don't think it's the official name.
Is his character's name.
Who is he? He's here right now, actually.
He's going to be on the show in just a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, and that's where it cuts.
But you
was not found.
You wrote the story about the customized version, and Cooper Zelnick had made it.
Yep.
How close is it?
It's not that close. I think they share like a similarity, but that one's based on the SL,
gotcha,
which is like a different case shape. But you know, they're all from that same Ingenieur line.
Mm-hmm.
But the one for the F1 movie, which is part of several watches for the movie, but this is the one that Brad Pitt's character wears, is said to wear in the film. I haven't seen the movie, but. I think it's, they kind of took that inspiration and then fit it into how they currently run the line.
Cool.
Because I believe the version that he was wearing in the spy shots didn't have, you know, like the cross check grid style dial and that sort of thing. But yeah, I wanted to squeeze that in at the end of the episode because I just thought those 35s were sweet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the other plus is with a small watch like a 35, even when they put all the links in, when it closes, it fits my wrist. A full-size 40 has, you know, like 5 spare links. And I've said this before for people who listen a lot. Those integrated bracelet sports watches are two different things, sized and unsized. It's you're missing like 30% of the experience.
How do you think I feel? It's constantly like this. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes we get handed ones that must have 8 spare links. And you could literally just like...
make two watches. Okay.
Anyways. That's the episode for today. That's day 3. I hope we covered some of your favorites. If not, let us know in the comments and we can get it into tomorrow's episode. We've got a very busy schedule tomorrow all over town. I get to see my favorites, one of my favorites from the show with Doxa, and they've got a GMT. So James is going to be in a good mood, I think. And I hope you guys enjoy the episode and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks so much for being on, guys.
Nice.